You are listening to Tempest in the Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
And together we're agitating for change in Northern BC. In this episode, which we've entitled The Best Kind of Gateway Drug, Jolene Swain of Woodgrain Farm will try to answer for us the question, can we be self-sufficient in the North? Spoiler alert, it's easier than you think. And people here have been enticed by plants to do just that for a very long time. Time to check the pot and see what's cooking. Fireweed, or Epilobium angustifolium, is a tall, hardy perennial plant known for taking over burned or disturbed land. It grows quickly after fires. Fireweed comes up like a promise that the land will be okay. It has small, lance-shaped leaves and tall spikes of purple or pink flowers. The northern indigenous view fireweed as food and medicine. You'll find it in jellies, honey, and skin products. Fireweed grows along the side of the road virtually everywhere in the north, partly because it produces numerous seeds with a fluffy white tuft that aids in wind dispersal. The seeds are key to a plant's survival. You might say seeds are key to our survival too. That is, if you want to continue to eat plants. And just holding a handful of seeds makes you see the potential for growing food. The effect on you is like that of an addictive drug. You just want to plant some promise in the ground. Jolene Swain is a biologist, organic consultant, and seed farmer. She specializes in organic seeds, vegetables, and foraging while promoting regional food security and operating as a mentor for new farmers. Along with her partner, Jonathan Knight, Jolene runs Woodgrain Farm in the Kispeaux Valley, which is where Brenda and I got a tour of her fields and her greenhouses, full of growing things.
So this was a variety of bok choy that we're growing called Shanghai Green, so just a really nice open pollinated bok choy that most Asian greens tend to be hybrids, especially like Napa cabbages and bok choys. Otherwise, they're quite variable, but I find this to be quite a nice variety. Yeah. And then this corn is part of a project with Going to Seed, and they really focus on land grace varieties that are really diverse in genetics. So taking a lot of different varieties and letting them cross and trying to adapt them to wherever you are. So this is kind of like a polar corn mix, like it's a cold, hardy, sweet corn. So I'm kind of growing it out to see how it does here. So far, I'd say it's a little late, but it is kind of a slow season. Mm. Now that it's tasseling, it's not tasseling super evenly. You know, if this was a hybrid, they'd all be like at the exact same stage. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of an interesting observation that in order to get good pollination, you do need enough plants and corn because it's wind pollinated. So we'll see how the kernels look when we get them. I find it also is tillering a lot, and that could be a result of our fluctuating temperatures this spring.
So tillering
which isn't a desirable trait. It's when it sends out all these little side shoots. It's something grasses do, and corn is a grass. So if you're growing like a field of barley and suddenly your barley starts to tiller, rather than getting some really nice seed heads, you get like a bunch of different stages of maturity seed heads, which can be problematic if you're trying to harvest all at once. That's not a problem at small scale, fortunately. I can harvest as things are ready.
So you use the term land race.
It's an interesting term, and I feel like there's other language that could be used around that, but it comes mostly from the wheat world, where different regions would grow a handful of grains and just over time keep selecting the ones that did best where they were or had the traits they were looking for, whether it was height or early maturity or tolerance to drought or, you know, so starting off with as a broad genetic base, which often could mean many different varieties growing all together, but selecting for the ones that kind of all have the similar traits. I mean, you don't want things harvesting at all different times, especially in grain production. And with mm-hmm. grain, you know, there's always been this movement away from grain that gets too tall mm-hmm. and might lodge. And then if you live somewhere really wet, then if you have broad genetics, you can start selecting ones that are thriving.
Work for your, quote, land.
Yeah, so the main difference between like a land race versus a hybrid is a hybrid is basically two identical parents that are crossed. So every offspring is diverse, but it's identical to each other. Whereas with a land race, you've got a multitude of parent lines that all mix together, so you maintain a lot of that genetic diversity
year over year.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you can bottleneck anything. If you say from like one plant, you lose all that. You only end up with two genes of each trait, right? We'll get into like genetics.
Yeah. So you're not trying to go from, say, land race into, say, hybrid in terms of finding the perfect and then narrowing. But you're kind of constantly working with genetic diversity every year, knowing every year might be slightly different as
well. Like you don't want to lose that diversity because... Yeah.
The resilience that comes from diversity.
If you start selecting for like drought tolerant, but then you have like, especially up here, we don't want to go too strongly in any direction. We want a crop that responds to the seasons, and that's where open pollinated and land race varieties thrive, because they have the genetics in there somewhere. Maybe not all the plants will thrive, but some always will. Whereas with a hybrid, either they're all great, or it could just be a whole crop that doesn't perform because it didn't get the nutrients it needed, it didn't get what it needed.
And with climate change, you really need resilience.
Exactly. Okay. Big time. So that's where that conversation around losing diversity comes out of, is just by the direction we're moving in towards more and more hybrid production, where the seed becomes proprietary because only the seed companies have rights to that parent line. No one else can grow them or play with them, and we stop growing some of these more diverse mixes because they're not as reliable or consistent, or, you know, they might lack in some traits, but in the long term, in the broader scale of things with climate change, with unpredictability, diversity,
everything's
is
becoming
key.
More unreliable and inconsistent. Yeah.
And chaotic.
And then you can't grow the hybrids yourself, so you're relying on the seed coming from way somewhere else, could be grown. It's part of a global seed system that definitely does not support a local food system.
Wow. Okay, you just encapsulated seed saving.
So
okay,
I guess we're done here.
thank you for your important work, because suddenly I realize what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, and some of these squashes are the same. It's like a mix of, I'm growing mostly red curry this year as my Maxima, and then I have a Delicata as a seed trial that we're doing with Farm Folk City Folk, comparing two different seed sources. So it's open pollinated seed, but from two different seed sources, just to see how they compare, because sometimes you actually don't even know what's really what you're getting out there and if what something says it is, it is. And then I'm growing there's another polar mix of squash, and it's in the butternut family, which butternut's a bit more of a heat-loving crop. So I'm kind of curious to experiment with this one land race type. This is Dijon mustard.
Oh, cool.
I grew a lot of it this year. I have two rows, and then the field in front of the house is also Dijon mustard. I got it from a small seed company. I don't know how it relates to like the commercial varieties and the registered varieties. You know, I'm not even sure if the Latin name is correct that was on the seed I bought. I'm very curious, trying to dive into it. I almost need to go talk to like a commercial grain grower, but they would probably just be like, I don't know what the grow this like variety XYZ. and
so will you be selling it and as like with powder?
No, I don't plan on, other than like maybe personal, trying to make some mustard. I'll sell it through the seed co-op, and I'll share it if people want to try like making mustard. Sure.
Oh, I would love to try making mustard. Wouldn't that be a fun thing to do this fall and winter?
Yeah, I know. I've always wanted to. I've grown it a few years, and I still haven't gotten around to it. So this September, we're having I don't know if it's going to be ready by then, but Hannah's making a food for our, like, doing a culinary showcase, and I'm hoping that we can have some of this mustard seed featured in the food, like seed as food.
Yeah.
As a focus, because we forget that a lot of the foods we eat are actually the seeds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I have one other breeding project here, which is part of the Citizen Seed Trial, and they started out as a big trial of beets, and then a couple of seed growers grew them out for seed and let them cross. But each grower took a different direction. Like one selected more for like stripy yellow beets, and one selected for red and long or something. So we're growing them side by side, and then we'll pull them up and make observations about the roots and the size and the yield and the flavor, and a very diverse mix. Like no one beet will be alike, which is kind of fun because you can even see like some of the leaves are red and orange and pink. And so there's a lot of variability within the population. So I could be harvesting it now. Just as soon as it's harvested, I have to deal with it. So
yeah, that's right.
Leave it in the ground.
Well, and it's an interesting. It's almost like peer-reviewed science. Like you're then getting the seed from them to grow and observations, right? So it's a community you're working.
And this is part of the citizen seed trial. Yeah. So there's like maybe like 100 other people growing the same seed out side by side and making observations and getting to kind of experience that. Oh, hey, maybe every beet doesn't have to be round and red.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of fun to have this diversity in our, especially for your home garden. Like I understand for farmers, like often they do need consistency, you know, if you're selling for market or you're trying to harvest, but in a home garden, this is where I think we have the power to maintain a lot more of this diversity. We don't need to be buying hybrids because we don't want things to be all ready all at once. The more staggered, the more diverse they are, the better.
The more color on the plate, the healthier it is for you.
Yeah.
But also the more fun it is.
Totally. Yeah.
Like, why does a bead have to be red? You're right.
Exactly. And you can buy, instead of buying like a yellow bead and a red bead and a striped bead, you can buy this one package of mixed beads.
Yep.
And
Bob,
also,
your uncle.
Yeah. Yeah. And support, you know, people in our local seed system and keep diversity in our food crops.
Yeah. And a healthier gut, I would think.
Yeah, our, you know, our diets have narrowed down
like
so much.
Like a monoculture going on in there right now, right?
And
if you need diversity in your
like
gut.
How many brassicas can we fit into our... Like, as we go into the tunnels, where I'll show you 5 different kinds of brassicas. Because brassicas are great here. This is just my canning tomatoes. Yeah, and the echinacea's in bloom.
Oh, look at all the pollinators.
It's definitely, I think, one of my favorite flowers. Yeah. Yeah, it is prolific. Like, it's coming up everywhere. I mean, whatever. It could be worse things, but I keep, try to keep it contained here.
Because this is a mint, right?
And that's motherwort.
Motherwort. I'm like, now what
it's
do I do?
It's very medicinal stuff. Yeah.
Very medicinal, yeah.
But it's like, very prolific self-seeder as well.
And the mullein. And then mullein,
Purple ultra cross-collards. It's a collard breeding project from down south. Ujamaa seeds, you know, bringing back traditional foods. And so that's a... I picked the purple. I was at the seed conference and was like, well, I don't, never really grown collards and I don't really know what to do with them. I mean, other
so
than
down south being southern US.
So this is like a southern exposure seed exchange, like way Virginia and
they
South
seem
Carolina.
To grow all right up here though.
Oh, yeah. I still haven't really tried cooking much with them, but they are.
I'm like, are they much different than other brassicas in flavor?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely have kind of that, you know, waxier leaf than a lot of kales. I think they're Oleraceae. This is part of a medicinal plant breeding project. They're called leopard lilies. The root is medicinal. I'm moving more and more towards perennials in here. So this is actually a perennial arugula.
Oh.
So rather than like bolt and just become like all seed, it just grows really slowly and it is making seed, but it still has beautiful leaves.
Yeah.
I love it.
Oh yeah.
The first time I tried to grow it was when we were still market gardening.
So the stuff is so slow. Like, what's wrong with this? But
then now understanding its perennial attributes and realizing I can have like arugula whenever I need. Here's your perennial arugula.
Oh my gosh, it's such a tiny seed.
It's very tiny, hey?
Like if I put that in my pocket,
I'd carry that around with you.
Oh, I might have some envelopes over here. Oh yeah, so those are garlic chives. Oh,
no,
those
but
flies?
The flies, they're
new
to
me. Tons of those around here.
They're so beautiful.
Yeah, they're neat. I don't know, I'm curious what they are too.
And oh, because I was like, did you introduce them? Because they're just like loving this spot.
Yeah, they're growing that one plant.
They are a prolific pollinator around here. So yeah, I'm trying to move more into perennials, like all this leopard lily overwintered from last year. It's actually like zone 7, but we had a pretty mild winter, so.
Isn't that asparagus growing
in? Yeah. I started some from seed last year, and then I didn't really know where to put it. So I was like, well, I'll just keep it alive in here until I figure out, like,
And is it moved to perennial time saver, life saver?
Yeah, like, tropical. Oh, right here, this is a perennial spinach.
Oh!
I just cut it way back. It was all the way to here. It forms like a vine.
Wow.
The seed is actually all over. You see this little tiny, these little shiny seeds? They're like little gems.
Oh, yeah.
Look how bright and shiny they are. So this overwintered last year, and it's great. So yeah, that'll be up in like March. So it's a
season extension because
without
you're
the work
not
of being like, oh, what should I start? And like
babying them.
Yeah. So the perennial arugula, the perennial spinach, Yeah, I've started a few winter greens for, yeah, obviously the thyme and lavender are a little bit chaotic. The garlic chives are just do really well.
I love the chaos of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and then all the basils in there, just... Yeah, and then the grapes. We just harvested these. It's our first year.
Wow.
I mean, I planted
the grapes?
I planted them last year.
Okay. Oh, okay.
That was their first year. Yeah, so they got established last year. They grew a little bit up here. And then, yeah, this is their second year, and they just, like... Yeah, I mean, I think this is a hardy and a variety that... Yeah, I'm kind of like, well, maybe I should move this one outside and get something a bit...
More.
So we're just harvesting some seeds now because, luckily this year, given our weather, I left some of our crops this spring in the tunnels to go to seed. So we had a whole row of arugula, and I just left a section of it to go to seed. So this is arugula.
Is
that celery? It's a pretty small crop. I'll do a bigger crop next year, but I usually try to do like a full row. I find shallot is a little hard, or onion seed is hard to do around here. Doing it in the tunnel definitely helps get that season extension. These are some beans from Vicky at Thimbleberry Farm.
Oh yeah.
That she really loves. So I'm really excited to try them as if they're a dry bean. I love molasses face.
Molasses face.
This is my purple sprouting broccoli that I love. It's really flavorful. Mm-hmm. Again, it's a cross of two kales and a broccoli. Kales tend to be more biannual before they seed, whereas broccoli is often an annual. So that means it has a really nice diverse genetic base again, so you can really see that in the colors, the purples and the greens. And so I love that about it, but it's also really flavorful and tasty. Feel free to...
So does that mean though, because it's this cross, if you're also growing it around other brassicas, will it heat crossing, and so you're gonna lose maybe the qualities?
Yep, yeah, I have to be careful not to grow other... So I'm not actually doing a seed crop. So last year I did seed for broccoli. This year, this is all just volunteer stuff that we're getting ready to kind of start pulling out of here. I'm just committed to not doing any seed. It's slow. It takes a while before you get like... If you're doing seed around this region, one of the most important things is that you have to start early. You need your full growing season. So if I'm going to do a seed crop out of broccoli, like I need to start that seed in March.
Yeah.
So that I get as long as possible for it to get to the heading stage, to the flowering stage, and then finally to like the dry seed.
Yeah, because if you think we're already trying to extend our seasons to get just more food production, it's even further to get to seed.
Yeah, and I know someone commented one time, they're like, oh, we didn't get around to doing like a food garden, so we thought we'd do a seed garden, and it's like, it's the other way around, actually.
Yeah.
Plan your seeds first.
Is that beans of some sort?
Yeah, soybeans.
Oh,
okay.
I grew this variety once before. It's supposed to be kind of a shorter season, but I find it's not super fast to get
fuzzy.
It will, like it's flowering now, so they're fast once they start flowering. Yeah, should get a little bit of soybeans out of it. I'd like to do a trial next year on different soybean varieties that are suited to shorter seasons. Yeah, I love growing soy, but... And then this is one of those going to seed Landrace melon mixes. So these are kind of like a short season melon.
Oh, yeah.
They'll be quite diverse. And then those watermelons are part of another Farm Folk City Folk cross of all the short season watermelon varieties. So they're quite diverse, and part of the selection process is to taste them and pick the ones that are the most delicious. So they're just coming on too. Given our slow start to the season, everything, I think, is just catching up now.
In this next clip, I mention one of my favorite food writers, Michael Pollan. He's published several popular books on the topic, but one that many people overlook is The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World. In this book, Pollan suggests four human desires that are reflected in the ways we selectively grow, breed, and genetically engineer plants. The thing is, Pollan is suggesting that the plants are working some sort of magic on us, developing these desires based on whether they can convince us to help them successfully reproduce. For instance, apples weren't always sweet, but they've evolved, through a blend of plant science and natural history, to offer flavors that will appeal to our palates. We think we're higher beings, but plants often manipulate us for their own purposes. I highly recommend this entertaining and fascinating book.
No. I know this is a weird question, but have you ever read Michael Pollan's The Botany of Desire?
Of course.
I love that book because I love that we've been played by plants.
Yeah, exactly. I know when you asked me, like, why did I grow soybean? I don't know. It made me.
Yeah.
Soybeans made me grow hostage. It. They don't even do that well here, but I just like...
Maybe that's why I always have to have borage, because I'm like, yeah, the flowers are edible.
Yeah.
You're like, they're so finicky. I can't preserve it. It seems to go counter to everything I normally...
They've trained us.
Yep.
That's it. We're co-evolving, right?
Yeah,
it's not a one-way relationship.
I was like, why don't you ask the plants?
Yeah.
Well, they are sentient beings, right? And we don't take that into account at all, ever.
I'm doing a little crop of tobacco this year.
Oh, you too.
Yeah, okay. It's just a fun little plant. Some black kabuli garbanzo beans.
I've got these. I think I got them at the seed swap.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do because like, I'm not going to get enough.
I know. They're also one of those where it's like, you're not going to be very productive. I'm going to get like maybe a cup of peas if I'm... But they're such a pretty plant.
But I was going to say, if I knew how pretty they were going to be, like next year, I just might plant them in a different spot.
Yeah.
Like, I had no idea even what the plant was going to look like.
I mean, these are a little stressed because I've been fighting with ants. This was all garbanzos. So I think they're not supposed to be this beautiful and red. These ones are a bit more healthy here, but... I've kind of given up on my battle, and I'm trying to coexist. And these are all dry beans, and then green beans, favas, holy basil, which is part of our citizen seed trial for the farm. More collard greens.
And then that will be next year. So it's a biennial seed crop.
Shallots. So this will be my seed crop for next year. If we don't eat them all.
I was going to say, it's so hard. It'd be so hard.
Yeah,
that's what I'm thinking.
I tried to plant enough so that... So we might end up eating them. You know, you gotta feed the farmer first.
It's
so tempting.
It is, yeah.
You are listening to Tempest in the Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barron.
Before the break, Brenda and I were visiting Jolene Swain at her home on Woodgrain Farm. We were discussing the notion of saving seeds, a very old practice that we should all be taking more seriously right now. And Jolene reminded us repeatedly how much joy seed saving can bring. But more fundamentally than the pure joy factor, saving seeds is extremely practical. When you save seeds, rather than relying on our capitalist system to provide the right kind, the best quality, and a wide enough variety of garden seeds every year, you have more agency over what you can plant. We've been trained to believe that someone smarter than us should do all that work on our behalf. But I prefer to know exactly what I'm eating, and to feel the satisfaction of having grown it myself. I also love being able to support my local farmers in those same efforts. Now, back to that farm table and what seed saving means for our community and our plates.
I had met someone who was into, a few people were into saving seeds, and they did a demonstration at the Organic BC conference. And I was intrigued. Right away, I joined the BC Eco Seed Co-op. Yeah, I want to work with other farmers and be able to focus on fewer varieties, do quality seed, preserve, steward, and then be able to network through this market collectively through the BC Eco Seed Co-op. So I'm one of over 20 members now that grow seeds for the co-op. I do some crops just to sell locally so that we have a local seed source, and just to bring awareness around like where seed is coming from. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a labor of love, but I also gives me a chance to learn and explore and think about which varieties I'm growing on this farm and could be growing, and try to explore varieties that others might know about.
What is the like local seed saving community like? Is the community, do you think it's growing?
I think it's definitely grown in the last 5 or so years. When I first got up here, there was a seed library at Sendon that unfortunately, you know, as the funding come and goes, some of these programs come and go. I was excited to kind of connect at a CD Saturday in Hazleton when I first arrived, and then that was almost the last one for years. Slowly over time, we have started to kind of see more of those come up for years, and I didn't have the capacity to both be a seed producer and
organize a seed library. You know, people do get quite excited about seeds, groundbreakers through conversations and on, you know, through their own kind of interest, started a little seed library, which has been maintained. And now they're doing quite regular Seedy Saturdays. We've been doing a regular Seedy Saturday at Briskina Storytellers, which has been really nice to bring that back. So I think that has helped things grow. But there's a difference between like trading and sharing seeds versus actually having a local seed security or sovereignty. I think we still have a ways to go there, but you know, we don't have to do everything here. You know, regional seed supply would be amazing, but not all varieties thrive here for seed production. So there's people in the south or the Caribou who might be better suited to grow some. So it's creating a network, I think, is important. But yeah, I would love to see maybe people not go like into seed production, as farming is very, very hard to maintain or do. And we don't have, especially on this end of the region where it gets starts getting wetter, not the ideal climate all the time. But I always try to encourage farmers to incorporate, you know, one or two seed crops. And, you know, maybe through the resources we offer with the seed cleaning trailer, connecting through the co-op, that we'll be able to provide support for farmers to do that. It's a slow moving train, but I think there is a growing seed community and hopefully growing awareness.
Wood Grain Farm is certified organic. Now, that's a wonderful goal, but and has a high standard to live up to. So does that just add to your challenges as a farmer?
Yeah, we've been certified organic for probably 15 years. And it adds a challenge as a diverse farm. The more crops and projects you have, the more complicated your paperwork gets. And keeping track of everything is an important part of the standards, because that's how they keep things verified. We believe in organics and we're really happy to be part of that community. So it is valuable for the co-op to be able to say that the seed came from a certified organic farm. And the value in having certified organic seed is that that seed was selected for organic growing conditions. Whereas if you think of seed that's coming from a conventional farm, if you have a pest, maybe you spray for it. If you are organic, you breed resistance into that seed crop because you're selecting for the plants that are able to resist the pests and disease. So I think certified organic seed is pretty important, and so it helps to have it labeled as such. So yeah, it's extra work. We'll probably keep doing it, mainly because of the community, and because of the organic community, it also puts more interest and research into organics, because the more organic farmers there are, the more interest there is, the more funding there is to do trials and research and select towards organic systems. So we're kind of part of it as part of the broader system, not so much locally at this point.
But as an eater, I'm the one who benefits in the long run.
Yeah, and I that's a huge part of it too, is if you aren't able to go visit your farmer or see their farm, having that certification, that third-party review and inspection, and learning and knowing those guidelines and standards, and often going above and beyond them, gives the consumer a lot more confidence in your product, and it gives you more choice at the marketplace to at least know more about how your food was grown.
This idea of bringing community back into the system being primarily the one I've been raised in, that's much more capitalist, I guess, and much more individualistic driven. But if it's more, one of the solutions is bringing community back into that, do you agree with that sentiment? And if so, what does that actually mean to you?
Yeah, I think there's kind of two parts to this. So the idea of community sufficiency versus self-sufficiency comes to mind. And I know as a small farm and a lot of new farmers and homesteaders, they aspire to be self-sufficient. Very quickly you realized, I don't want to be self-sufficient. I want to be community sufficient. Nice. I want to be able to focus on a few things, just like with the co-op. I want to focus on being a good garlic grower and carrot grower so that someone else can focus on being a good potato grower or provide other greens to the community so that we're not trying to do it all for the community and for ourselves. And I think we need community to be involved in our food systems. You know, not everyone needs to be a farmer and not everyone needs to grow their own food, but at least being aware of where our food is coming from and having a lot more people involved in the food system is important for having food security or food sovereignty. And yes, but in our regions, we're relying so much on food coming and seed coming from outside, and that isn't sustainable.
It's also not sustainable to make farmers grow things they don't want to grow.
Yeah.
I want you to be a happy farmer, right? Otherwise, you're going to get out of it, and then I've lost a farmer.
Yeah, if we expect farmers to do it all, then that's exactly how we lose farmers, because mm-hmm. we also want them to do it all and to also compete with a global marketplace, which yeah. is a very different system and with very little support. And it's a tough go. So
realizing that it's good to have the skill and knowledge to do a lot of things, that doesn't mean I have to mm-hmm. do it all. Actually, I value the person who does it for me
yeah.
even more, because I know how hard it is, right? Mm-hmm. But that idea that we have
yeah.
to know how to do everything and do it all for ourselves as a success measure is probably leading to burnout across
yeah.
so many parts of society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't value food production
yeah.
and seed production. Because it seems like, oh, you're just, maybe it's just like gardening, how fun.
Yeah, yeah, we romanticize it, right?
Yeah, they romanticize it. And I think people underestimate the amount of skill and knowledge. It's shocking to me, really, that farming isn't a trade, considered like a red seal. You know, in some countries it is, and for good reason.
Yeah.
Like, it's a big learning curve going into farming, and new farmers who don't have a support system struggle. If you don't have farms around you to learn from, a network to grow from, it's gonna be hard.
What does seed saving involve that's different from regular farming?
Seed saving means selecting varieties that perform well in our region. So seed saving gives us an opportunity to grow varieties that are unique to this area in a larger seed system. We're being provided varieties that do well on a broad scale, but there might be things that thrive here. And if we don't do it ourselves, then nobody else is going to do it for us. Compared to a food system, it's a bigger commitment on your land. When you put a seed crop in, it's going to be there for the whole season. You know, with food crops, you're going to be turning those beds over. It could be a big loss if you have a failure, if you don't get the weather you need, if it rains at the wrong time during harvest and the seeds sprout on the plants. Sometimes it's a two-year process to get a biennial seed like onion or carrots. So you're actually waiting over 2 years before you might see a return. So it's a very different kind of farming in that sense. On the flip side, I guess if you grow enough seed, you could be selling that seed for 3 years or more. I mean, at the co-op, we test our seed every year. We only keep seed up to 3 years. Regardless, but it still gets tested every year. So yeah, you kind of got to aim for like population sizes, dial in how much seed to grow so that you're not growing too much seed either. If you don't have a market for it, or then you can easily grow a lot more seed than like even here, I can grow more seed than I could really sell locally, because one seed crop, in order to have the population levels I need to maintain the diversity I want and the genetics of the plants, I need a high population size, which is going to give me way more seed than people could ever use locally. So having this broader network is really helpful. I could do smaller seed crops, but then I'd start losing diversity in my seeds. Mm-hmm. So this is where we need a community effort of growing seeds, not relying on just a few farms to grow all the seeds. And that's where I think this cooperative model is really beneficial.
Thinking of conventional farming, things that have been put in place to help support it, there's a lot of financial stability and insurance program. If you're a wheat grower in the prairies, or if you're even a cattle farmer in the prairies, you can insure your cattle if your crop is wiped out, right? Are there those kind of tools and mechanisms available?
Not that I know. You kind of have to be of a certain scale for it to be worthwhile and to go through all that paperwork of like saying, okay, I'm growing, you know, even if we grew like an entire acre as one seed crop, like a grain, you know, I guess we grow several acres of grain. I don't know if it'd be worth the paperwork, but for any kind of small, diverse farm, we don't even fit into a category when we do our taxes and the census. Like, it's all, you know, do you grow grain or do you, like, it's hard to explain a diverse farm to.
Yeah. For a commodity system built tools, potentially some of those tools could come in, but they'd have to look so different to be appropriate and to be actually helpful.
Yeah.
People sometimes look at this small little package of seeds and, what? How come it costs $5?
Yeah.
You've just talked about 3 years of investment put in that small package.
Well, and the amount of food that you're going to get out of that little package
is
far more valuable than $5, but we don't see that when you're shaking a couple of seeds around, right?
Yeah. Yeah, seeds are interesting that way. They can be incredibly abundant, but at the same time, most people aren't going to be able to use that many seeds in a growing season. And then in order to recoup those costs that went into that bed, not only do you now end up with a crop, but now what do you do with that crop?
Yeah.
And that's a big part of like seed saving, is that it just, or any perishable product, it's got a shelf life and you want to get it out to their customers while it's at its prime.
You know, one other thing that occurs to me is in Ontario, they used to talk a lot about heritage seeds, like they're recovering the heritage. Do we ever do that up here, recover heritage seeds?
Or? Yeah, well, heritage is an heirloom, are kind of the interchangeable terms, and that usually means a seed that's been around for around 100 years, a variety that's been kind of stabilized and preserved for 50 to 100 years. And so a lot of the open pollinated varieties we grow are heritage or heirloom seeds, which is really valuable because we know what their traits are, why they've been preserved, what people like about them. They're also an interesting source to experiment with. So that's where some of these breeding projects come in. So we no longer can call it a heritage or heirloom seed because it's got those heirloom genetics, but they're now crossed with, so they've become a new variety or a new cross, which is also kind of part of the whole lifespan of our food system. It's evolving. And I think it's important we do maintain heritage and heirloom varieties, but also that we continue to work with these varieties in our changing climate and our changing world and in our different regions.
Right.
We have become accustomed to convenience. Go buy it, grow it, see how it goes. And seed saving is extra work or different work. So why does it matter?
Why is there so much passion in this, Jolene? Because the rest of us are like, oh my God, I'm exhausted just watching it.
I mean, I'd be in a very different place right now if I wasn't working for Farm Folk, City Folk as the Northern Seed Security Coordinator. That gives me an opportunity to work with seed systems as part of a nonprofit and support some of the work that I already am doing and want to do without just giving up all of my time, because then I would probably be very burnt out and super poor. You know, I'm really grateful that this organization exists and that they have the BC Seed Security Program. Also, that community that we have through the BC Eco Seed Co-op and Organic BC provides kind of support system where I know I'm not alone and I'm not having to do everything myself. And I don't think without those networks, I could keep doing the seed work, or at least not on any kind of capacity. And so that's why through the work with the Seed Security Program, I try to bring that support network to more people to hopefully grow our seed saver networks regionally. Being the Northern coordinator helps me really focus on just continuing to bring that message to people and letting them know that there are supports out there and there's our communities and that we don't have to do everything by ourselves, but let's see if we can do it together.
I'm thinking of like what contribution beyond the pragmatic. Like I'm just thinking of like you go to a seed event and there's so much joy and excitement, as much as like, see what I have, I'm taking this home. Food as part of culture and celebration and story. And I just wonder what you've seen it bring to you or what you see in others that it's contributing being part of seed saving and seed exchanging beyond the pragmatic.
It's like, why am I saving seeds? I guess they asked me to, or they guided me this way, because even in the work I do, whenever I work with children, we call beans it's the entrance into the seed world. You give a pods to children and they start and adults you start popping seeds out of a seed pod full of colors, like
that's colors and
you
sizes.
Just see the look textures on people's faces and the looks in their eyes and the excitement. Jewels. And like it just brings out this,
it's like giving them smack.
yeah it's the gateway. The gateway to seed saving. Beans are the gateway. I don't know, I'd love to dive more into where that that energy and excitement come from, because you know, you see like a jar of seeds, or this is that perennial spinach, I'm like, look how shiny it is. I've been staring at this seed all week. Every day I just like come and like look at how shiny and beautiful this seed is, and then you think about that one of these seeds can form an entire plant that was 5 feet high in my greenhouse this year and overwintered and it's been alive for 2 years just making greens and flowers and more
how
seeds.
Much knowledge one of those little seeds carries.
Yeah.
And like Cliff and said hope. The same thing at Sigidag this morning, right? About, he was talking about the tomatoes, right? But you put this tiny little seed in and then like, it's like, look, right? There's a big vine, right? And just.
There's got to be something in our consciousness that knows this, because even before you understand the biology or the importance of seed, like children, they know. We know whenever we're working with seeds, there's so much power in these little packages of starchy, sugary.
I just love Michael Pollan's take on it, that they're sentient beings that are taking advantage of us. It's a wonderful relationship that they've got as much power as we have, at least.
Yeah, we're not growing seeds. They're growing us.
Our podcast is rooted in exploring equity and justice within the food system, and I'm curious how you see seed saving contributing to this locally and globally. Would you say there's a difference between food security and sovereignty for you?
I think by definition, you know, seed security is that we have a seed available, but seed sovereignty is that we produce the seed ourselves. So that's definitely the approach that I'd like to see more of. Again, you know, we don't have to do it all, but we've got to preserve and steward the varieties that are important to our region. And then that definitely gets into the question around cultural and equity-based food systems. So preserving and, I guess, acknowledging and supporting communities and cultures to preserve the seeds and varieties that are important to them. That's obviously can get into a tricky work. You know, you don't want to walk in and be like, oh, I'll preserve this for you. Or it can be a contentious issue in the seed world where, if you think of, especially down south, like different corns and beans, they often have indigenous names like Hopi red dye amaranth is a, where did it get that name? Well, that seed was preserved by the Hopi, and now a settler seed company is selling it for profit. Is that okay? I mean, on one end of things, they're helping preserve it, and that's valuable, but do they have permission?
Yeah, do we call that appropriation?
How are they acknowledging where that seed came from and the story behind it? Or if you look at the binomial system for naming things, like why do we call, you know, tomatoes Solanum lycopersicum, or you know, where did that come from, and why is it called this now? And then what was it before, since these seeds have been around for thousands of years, not just the last couple decades?
So they didn't have a Latin name back then.
Yeah, they definitely didn't. Yeah, they definitely weren't part of the binomial nomenclature. As a settler, that work weighs on me for good reason, and as it should. I try to give it a lot of thought. It's challenging where we are, because there are a lot of the seeds I'd say that are more culturally significant a lot of the seed I'm growing is not from here. It's a lot of it's been brought over. And I mean, a lot of things were traded at some point. If you think of potatoes, like they have a long indigenous history here. And at some point they were traded into the region. There's a lot of layers to that question. And I think a lot of it, the learning that we can get from that is to keep following the story of the seeds. I think that's what I've most recently been focused on, is thinking about where did the seed come from? What is its story? How did it get to me? And what am I going to do with it now that I know this?
Will I be a good steward?
And can I be a good steward of the seed? Or should I be a steward of this seed? Yeah, it's really fun to be next door to Sikadak and get to chat with Cliff. He's so enthusiastic, and also like exploring, you know, varieties from all over, because it's all part of that journey of how did some of these seeds end up here. They may not all have a story that is relevant to local cultures, but they got here, so that is part of their story.
Mm-hmm.
And now they are. So how do we honor that?
But it's like the seeds can teach us that too, because the joy and that they bring, and the less political stories, but it's that intertwined that maybe as we learn to honor the stories, see the stories, honor them, and celebrate them even going forward, we can also do that for each other as humans.
Yeah.
So
it's a big process, and it's an important work that we need to do as settlers in food systems. Have, you know, following the seed world, the topic has come up around these like certain varieties that were clearly stewarded or saved by indigenous communities, not to mention the countless seeds that have been lost through colonization and displacement. So there's a lot of heavy work being done to try to bring this seed back to communities. Rowan White is a Mohawk seed keeper who works on rematriation of seeds, which is all about bringing seed back to the people, in the hands of the people. And that sends very much those communities that have been stewarding them for generations and millennia. So I really follow her closely and try to be mindful of the work that she does when I'm doing my work. and keep learning of that important role that we play in stewarding these varieties. There's a saying, I think, from her that the seeds don't belong to us, they belong to our grandchildren. And we're just here for part of their journey. Mm-hmm. So just like food, you know, the whole idea of ownership and mm-hmm. commercialization is always gets complicated in our capitalist society. And I guess we just keep fighting the system from within at times and also finding alternative models. Part of what I do is selling seeds, but also part of what I enjoy doing is sharing seeds and then gifting seeds and sharing stories and resources and supporting the seed system. I consciously chose at a certain point when I was organic farming as a focus for food, I shifted more towards seed work because I really felt that was important, and that's the journey I'm on, and I'm glad I'm still doing it despite the moments of uncertainty.
Yeah.
You're involved in initiatives to attract more young farmers, like Young Agrarians, and they're wonderful initiatives. We applaud this, but is the solution to attract more young farmers into a system that often seems designed to work against them and leads to burnout?
Yeah, that's definitely something I've grappled with in my work, because as I've been fortunate to be in a position of working for a nonprofit where I do get some compensation for the work I do, you know, encouraging folks to kind of get into either seed work or farming when I know how precarious it can be is a challenge. And often these programs are band-aid solutions. They're not solving the underlying issues in our food system that we need more support for farmers so that more people can farm, and we need more diverse and local food systems. And we need to support new farmers and provide skills and knowledge sharing for new farmers. So there's, on the other end, having these programs are the support system to help people navigate the world we're in. And I think we've always tried to take a pragmatic approach with new farmers to help them through those realities and challenges they might face in farming. There's a reason we're still farming. It's a lifestyle choice. And I don't want to take that away from people just because there's some hard parts to it. It's hard to navigate, but without fully crushing the dream of like growing food, because I think it gives a lot of people fulfillment and there's a reason they're drawn to it. And I think despite the challenges, we have to keep trying. Yeah.
And I'd like to see a whole cultural and social shift because, you know, at the beginning of this conversation, you said we don't have Red Seal farmers, and mm-hmm. maybe we should, because that would give people a more sense of dignity about their work and how valued they should be. Mm-hmm. For heaven's sakes, they're mm-hmm. feeding us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If there's one career that's invaluable to me, there it is.
Mm-hmm. And I think I see that. I love seeing that with these projects at Sikadak, Witset, these community growing initiatives, and Tea Creek, where it's like involving the community in food and feeding the community. Like, what is more important than that?
They're growing competent eaters.
Yeah.
People who are involved with the food system.
Yeah. The people are learning about food that grows locally. They're experiencing what a fresh head of lettuce looks like, or what a potato looks like when it comes out of the ground. Like, you see again, you get back to children and the looks on their faces when they realize that food comes from plants.
And look at how much better it tastes when it just came out of the ground rather than going it the Safeway and it's been there for a week.
Yeah. Our food system needs to be more accommodating to anyone who wants to get into it. And I definitely question, you know, at times encouraging people to farm, but I also am still farming and so are others. And we do need more people growing food in many capacities. And it's just like having diverse seeds. You need diverse farmers and diverse food systems.
This podcast was generously funded by the Public Health Association of BC. Brenda Barrett is my co-lead and the executive director of the Storytellers Society in Hazleton. Technical production by me, Christine Bruce. Music by Elijah Larson. This episode's food expert was Jolene Swain in Kispiox, who spends her time saving seeds so they can continue to tempt us into behaviors that ensure both their own survival and ours. For more information on this or any other episode of Tempest in a Stockpot, visit storytellerssociety.org/tempest. Thank you for sharing this meal with us. I'm Christine Bruce, reminding you to stir that pot and give in to the temptation to eat local. As one of my beloved farmers reminded me recently, farmers need eaters. Back at you, Yoan Yuld.